it's murder, man. Coming from my bad land, real hardcore. Kick it down your front door. Let me get what's coming to me. Cause if I can't use my mind, I'ma grab the tech, Gordon.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the hard halls of academia. I'm your host, Alex West, with
Andrea Subisati, as always.
And we're here to bring you our Valentine's Day episode. Because, frankly, I feel like Andrea and I are kind of the Mulder and Scully of podcasting. I'm Mulder, obviously. And, you know, we always have that will they or won't they kind of thing. So, you know, it's good. We're going to talk about relationships, maybe figure out our own. Who knows?
Why are you Mulder?
Well, because you're a sociologist. So you're the doctor and you're always like, oh, there's a reason why people are scared, Mulder. And I'm like, no, there are ghosts. I want to believe. Also, our hair is very similar. I have very similar hair to David Duchovny.
Indeed.
Yeah. So for today's topic, as I mentioned, this is our Valentine's Day episode. I was not joking about that. I was joking about my hair. But today we're going to delve into another compare-contrast 1987's Fatal Attraction, directed by Adrian Lyne, and Fear from 1996, directed by James Foley, who also, interestingly, directed the film version of Glengarry Glen Ross, which is fantastic and very prestigious. Then he did Fear, so you know. And so to start us off, as always, we're going to do a quick recap of both of the films, and then we're going to start delving into the topics, take you through everything, and then bring you to our conclusion. So, Andrea, why don't we start off with Fatal Attraction?
All right. So Fatal Attraction, as mentioned, came out in 1987, and we've got Michael Douglas playing Dan Gallagher, who on the surface seems to have it all. You know, he's a successful New York attorney with a wife that he actually loves, imagine that, and a sweet daughter. And when his family is away for a weekend, he meets Alex Forrest, played by Glenn Close, through a business matter of some sort, which actually has to do with an affair, but anyway. They go for a drink, and after a bit of flirtation, Alex promises the utmost discretion, and they proceed to spend the weekend together. And they have fun, but before the weekend is out, it's pretty clear that Alex is totally unbalanced. You know, she flips out when he goes to leave, and she even slits her own wrists in order to get him to stay another night, which he does. He tries to break it off gently, but she won't stop calling him at home and at his office. Eventually, he changes his number and stuff, but then she slaps him with the ultimate, I'm not going anywhere, which is to say she's pregnant and she's keeping the baby. You know, at first she says she doesn't need or expect him to be part of their lives, but later she starts digging on him to be a man and take responsibility. He continues to avoid her, and her efforts for his attention get more and more extreme. Like, Dan moves his family out to Bedford, and she starts really terrorizing them, kidnapping their daughter Ellen and murdering their pet bunny. And that's when things get really serious, clearly. In the end, Alex attacks the family in their home, and they are able to kill her, and happy country life is restored.
And just before we move on to Fear, there are just a couple things I wanted to talk about very quickly in terms of the plot of Fatal Attraction. I don't believe that's their daughter. It looks like a boy. I don't care how many times they call him, her, Ellen. This is how Sleepaway Camp begins, okay? Sleepaway Camp, sorry, spoiler alert, but that is a little boy. It's adorable, but that ain't no girl.
I totally agree. I did think it was a little boy in the beginning, but I have to say Ellen charms the crap out of me in this movie. I don't usually like kids in movies. I don't like child actors. I don't like them, but I really liked Ellen. She was sweet.
Oh, so cute. That little boy is so cute. Second very quick thing, because we might not actually get to tackle this in our discussion. The first time Dan and Alex have sex, it's all very hot, it's all very passionate. They were going at it in her apartment. He gets her up on the sink, she turns on the tap, and starts splashing them both with water. I don't know what that is. I feel like that's so awkward and hilarious. I want to meet the next unsuspecting man I can and force that on him.
That's just middle-aged extramarital sex. That's just what it's like, Alex. Not saying I've been there, but that's what they do.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't know because I'm only like 18. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about those two things very, very quickly. But now we're going to skip ahead to 1996 with Fear. Now, Fear starts off with Nicole, who is played by Reese Witherspoon. She's, about a year ago, she's relocated to live with her father, whose name I think is like Dad McFather or something like that, played by William Peterson. And he has a new life with his younger wife, played by Amy Brennerman, something like that, yeah. And her son. So they're kind of a blended, melded family. And Nicole's kind of dissatisfied. She's a bit stroppy and kind of a bit irritated, but basically a normal teenager. She has her friend, her one guy friend, who's, I think, totally in love with her, probably.
Or gay.
One of the two. And her, you know, quote-unquote slutty opposite friend, Alyssa Milano, who we'll talk about later. And on one adventurous night, when Alyssa Milano gets, gets her to go out to this rave thing, she meets David, played by Mark Wahlberg, who is kind of a guy from the wrong side of the tracks, but makes himself seem like he's a really good guy and maybe just a little misunderstood, but he's really into her and she's really into him. And he makes an effort to get to know her family and, you know, seemingly an okay kind of guy, if not a little intense. You know, and then all the normal stuff happens. You get the montage where he wins her a peace pipe at the fair, and then he finger bangs her on the roller coaster while a shitty cover of Wild Horses plays.
I love it when you talk dirty.
Well, you can't see my hands right now. Anyway, so then things go a little off. They have sex for the first time. It's all very nice and consensual. The next day, David goes to pick Nicole up from school. He sees her best friend, who's either in love with her or gay, give her a hug to say goodbye. He then punches that guy in the back of the head. Nicole freaks out. In the kerfuffle, she gets hit in the face as well, getting a black eye. Totally shuts him out, won't see him, won't take his calls. And then he makes an appeal to her, saying, "All I wanted to do was protect you. I would do anything to keep you safe. You know, I love you." They get back together. And then Nicole's father confronts David, saying, "Stay away from my family. Stay away from my daughter." David fakes some injuries by punching himself. Nicole then takes David's side fully, runs off with him, tells him that she loves him. And he drops her off back at her house that night. She's not satisfied. She wants to see him again. So she drives up to this house where he and his buddies are staying, only to discover him forcing Alyssa Milano to have sex with him. So, of course, Nicole gets really mad at Alyssa Milano. A little bit at, like, Mark Wahlberg, but really at Alyssa Milano, which is very sad. And then, so she rejects both of them. David then takes it out on her father's car. Her father then breaks down their house and, like, rips everything apart and finds his little shrine to Nicole. And then Mark Wahlberg, or David, gathers his friends, one of whom I'm pretty convinced is the bastard son of Peter Sarsgaard and Rob Zombie, and gathers them to for the last 20 minutes of the film, which becomes a home invasion film. And they attack the family. The family kind of fends them off until ultimately there's a struggle in Nicole's bedroom where Mark Wahlberg is going to kill her father. Nicole stabs him with a peace pipe that he won her at the fair. And then William Peterson finally struggles again with Mark Wahlberg, throwing him out a window to his death.
So I have to say, when this movie came out, I was in high school, and it's a very teenage-oriented movie. Marky Mark was just starting out his rap career, which was kind of all the rage. He was kind of the babe du jour. He was doing Calvin Klein commercials, and he's topless a whole lot in this movie, so his form definitely helped get him the role. So yeah, I saw this with a group of friends in high school, and it was just kind of another teen thriller, and I was kind of astonished returning to it as an adult at how violent and extreme it is, and I just don't know if I was desensitized as a teenager or if I was just less critical of the violence that I saw, but I don't know about you, but on the rewatch, I found it really shocking.
No, I definitely think it's one of those films we've all seen at a sleepover. This was such a sleepover film. And it is quite shocking, the violence. And for me, it was also the slut-shaming aspect of it, that Alyssa Milano is such an overtly sexual character, and she's so deeply punished for it. And it just felt so trite and silly and very upsetting to watch, especially when you, the scene I was talking about before, where David forces her character Margot to have sex with him, and it's very clear he's forcing her, he's hurting her. And Reese Witherspoon will then turn her back on her. I just thought that was so upsetting, and especially if you think of this as a film meant for teenagers, goes back to that kind of lesson, which I think is becoming more predominant, thankfully, these days, which is don't teach girls how not to get raped, just teach men how not to rape, even though men are all instinct and passion, apparently. That's what I learned from these movies. And for me, Fatal Attraction, I think I only saw it a couple years ago, really. And it's, for me, it's one of my perfect hangover movies. It's so over the top. All the themes are so explained again and again, and everything is so deeply laid out that it's such an easy and kind of entertaining watch. And there are some decent performances in it, so it makes for a kind of good, kitschy run of a film to watch.
So we're going to start a little bit by talking about the dominating theme of patriarchy. I mean, everything in our culture is steeped in patriarchy, but we're going to talk a little bit about how these movies are kind of reinforcing certain patriarchal notions.
But Andrea, what is patriarchy and how do I know it?
Well, Alex, if it makes you feel like a dirty little slut, it's patriarchy and it keeps us in line. So talking about Fatal Attraction, I mean, like, one thing that this movie doesn't grant us is it doesn't give Dan a really good excuse for the affair, if such a thing even exists. It's not like his wife Beth is mean or unattractive or a drag in any way, or that he's locked into an unhappy marriage because of money or kids or because he works for his father-in-law or something like that. Like, there was maybe an indication that their sex life was kind of dwindling due to parenthood, but apart from that, they were for the most part happy. So watching this film, you know, you have to ask yourself, why did he do it? And I feel like the movie suggests that he did it simply because he's a man and he can. You know, in our patriarchal culture, male sexuality is treated like a loose cannon. And it's as if men are incapable of resisting sex if it's offered to them. And even if they're happily married, they can't help but take an opportunity to cheat. Now, it's a really offensive myth. It's reductive, and I attended the Slut Walk for the past 2 years in Toronto, which is about victim blaming. And, you know, every year there are plenty of male feminists in attendance who speak out, and they say that they're sick of victim blaming because it makes men out to be helpless victims to their dicks, which they're not, and they take issue with. And, like, masculinity is socially constructed just like femininity, and a big part of the feminist agenda is to critique all the ways in which patriarchy is harmful, and not just to women. Men suffer for it too. So within our patriarchal culture, there is a stereotype about successful male businessmen banging their secretaries. It's a lot more commonplace. It's a lot more acceptable for men to have affairs than women. The movie really draws attention to the social construction of masculinity, I think, in the scene where Dan and Alex are talking about how much they love Madame Butterfly. Madame Butterfly features madam. Prominently. Madam?
Yeah, Madame
Butterfly. Why Madam? There's an E at the end. It could be Madame.
I always heard it as Madame Butterfly.
Right in, folks. Let's talk about pronunciation. Little Miss Horror.
Hey!
So they're talking about Madame Butterfly. Maybe there isn't an E at the end. We'll Google that when we take our next break. And Dan thinks back to when he saw it as a kid, and he recalls being upset about how the madam, the heartbroken madam, was about to kill herself. And he says his father comforted him, and that it was one of the few times he remembered his father being nice to him. And it almost suggests that his father, who we all know is, you know, how boys learn how to be men, his father taught him how to be a man, and part of that was to not feel bad about this jilted woman's suicide and not feel too sorry for her. And I feel like that really translated into his relationship with Alex, where, you know, he had every reason to expect their affair to end on a dime. I mean, they really discussed it rationally. They discussed discretion at length, and he really believed he could get away with it without any negative consequences. And as far as I can tell, that is really the only reason why.
Hear it.
He likes spaghetti, especially the house.
Goes with the opera. It smells so good. Anything else for me to do?
No, nothing. Just make yourself at home. You can change the tape.
No, this is great.
I love Madame Butterfly.
Really? It's my favorite opera.
Mine too. It's the first opera I ever saw. My father, he took me to the old Met. I was 5 years old.
Did it make any sense?
Well, I got most of it. There was this U.S. sailor setting up house with this Japanese lady. That was all fine. But in the final act, after he left her, my father told me she's gonna kill herself. And I was terrified. I climbed right underneath the chair. It's right here. This is it, right? One of the only times I remember my father being nice to me when I was a kid. Comforting me at Madame Butterfly.
Another construct of patriarchy in Fatal Attraction, specifically, is the way Alex and Beth, his wife, are dealt with. Now, Beth is seen as kind of the perfect woman. She's a good mother, she's attractive, she's kind, she's a homemaker, you know, she's a great date to a party. Her only real conflict with Dan is that she wants to get a big house in the country, which, oh no, you're going to spend all my money again, woman. But ultimately, he does it because he needs to get away from Alex. And Alex, on the other hand, one of the things this film is known for is being a reaction to 80s feminism and all the feminism that came before it. It's a warning of what happens to independent women who strive for more in their careers and ultimately pay a price of loneliness and desperation and become crazy. And if you look up any of the reviews of this movie, there are plenty online. You know, she's a psychopath, she's cuckoo, she's Lady Danger, she's all these things, where she really does have some real mental issues. Dan even says that to her, but nowhere in there does anyone try to get her help. You know, she is seen as crazy and therefore must be punished because she is transgressive. And it's such a bland portrayal of a complicated topic. I mean, this is a topic that still we're dealing with now. You know, can a woman have it all? Can a man have it all? And how do you combine the two? So it's not to say that this discussion isn't important and it's not that it shouldn't be included in films. It's just, it's hard to watch. And I think feminists take issue with this film, or any woman should take issue with this film, because Alex steps outside of a gender norm. She is therefore punished for it. And Glenn Close, I was doing some research, when she got the part and got the script, she immediately took it to, I think, two psychiatrists and said, what's going on with this woman? Is it possible? And they said, yes, it is. And they gave her a whole list of the things that she was suffering from and how it would come about.
So what can I get you? I've got scotch, I've got vodka, there's a nice chablis in the...
Cut this shit, will you? Just cut it! I don't know what you're up to, but I'm gonna tell you it's gonna stop right now.
No, it's not gonna stop. It's gonna go on and on until you face up to your responsibilities.
What responsibilities?
I'm pregnant. I'm gonna have our child.
Alex, that's your choice, honey. That has nothing to do with me.
I just want to be a part of your life.
Oh, this is the way you do it, huh? Showing up at my apartment?
Well, what am I supposed to do? You won't answer my calls. You change your number. I mean, I'm not gonna be ignored, Dan.
Now, one thing I think we should talk about here is the alternate ending of Fatal Attraction. Now, you can find this online, and I will post it to our Facebook page. Oh, you should also like us on Facebook. And what happens, you can see the whole scene online, and it's an 8-minute scene. So instead of Dan returning home to pick up his wife from the hospital, it just cuts to Alex committing suicide. Very similar to Madame Butterfly, where Madame Butterfly slits her own throat. Alex does the same, but because she uses the knife that Dan had his hands on while the last time he was in her apartment, Dan is suspected of killing her. It's only when Beth, the wife, finds the tape from Alex to Dan that she can prove that Alex committed suicide. And it's such a different take on it, because it is Alex taking the violence out, not outward, but inward. And this is why you see less female serial killers. Women don't take anger outside of themselves, generally speaking, in, you know, psychiatry, or what I've learned from Law and Order Criminal Intent. They will inflict it upon themselves or someone very, very close to them before they take it out to random people.
No, that's right. She's a very tragic figure. And it's important to remember that this movie came out at a time where the single 30-something career woman was something of a novelty in film. I mean, they existed, but they hadn't become, you know, they weren't like a literary archetype just yet. And they weren't really glamorized, you know, until Sex and the City came along. And even that show has its share of critics who can't really tolerate how these women live their lives. But the 30-something career woman had a mystery to them. You know, there was you wondered why they were single, what was preventing them from having what every woman is supposed to want, which is a family. And this movie really reinforces this, because Alex does want a family desperately. And part of her obsession is a desire to have the little nuclear unit that Dan is already living. There's an indication that she missed the boat. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more flaws to Alex than her desire for a career and whatnot. But
hey, don't talk about me like that.
But Dan isn't entirely the villain here. And I have to say, he did play his cards right, with the exception of the major mistake of hooking up with Alex in the first place. He did have every reason to believe he would get away with it. And when he finally confesses, that confession scene is so sincere. And you really can't help but feel both for him and for his wife. And they are both so miserable that you almost do kind of side with Alex for a sec.
What I will say about that scene, I do agree with you on, you know, the sincerity of it. And I do feel that. But in that scene, if you listen to it, Dan admits to one night with her. It was a one-time thing. He doesn't say it was a weekend. I mean, if you can get away with saying one night, sure, say one night. I understand that. But it's a lie. It's a lie. They spent a weekend together. They made dinner together. They went to the park. They walked the family dog together. So it becomes a complicated thing. It's not quite as cut and paste, or, you know, cut and dry as it appears to be on the surface. And for me, I can't get around Dan getting off everything so easily. Like, she's mad at him, and then she gets in the car accident, and then he makes her tea, and it's fine.
You okay?
She's asleep. Did you call the police?
Not yet, no.
Why not?
Honey, we gotta talk.
What is it?
I know who did this. Remember the girl who came to the apartment? The one I met in the Japanese restaurant?
The one with the blonde hair? You're scaring me.
So sorry. The last thing I ever wanted to do was to hurt you.
Are you in love with her?
No, it was one night. It didn't mean anything.
No, it is true. I didn't actually catch that little sort of untruth that was in there. And I almost, he does get off kind of easy because of the circumstances, because of her accident. I mean, she obviously needs him at that moment. And yeah, it's interesting where the film ends, as you almost wonder what happened after that. But I think, it's implied that life went on and they repaired things as best they could. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the repair of their relationship and family unit when we compare with the last scene in Fear, which we're going to move on to shortly or right now. So moving on to Fear, as I said, it was a very teen-oriented movie that I only came to think more critically about rewatching it as an adult. And as an adult rewatching it, I was able to pick out that the main themes in this movie, you know, apart from how exciting and titillating the romance aspect was, is that the real conflict in this movie is actually between David and Nicole's father, Stephen. Stephen is kind of the gatekeeper of Nicole. He's very protective, and not just in and of himself, but he has created their home as this fortress. You know, security is paramount in this fortress, and everything is kind of automated, and there's codes. And I mean, the fortressing is kind of archaic by today's standards, but back then, it was a really heavily fortified beach home. You know, he seems overbearing, especially to me as a teenager, because, you know, I would, of course, relate with Nicole, and Nicole's not allowed to do stuff because her dad says no, and that sucks, and her stepmother's so mean, and I can't believe she said that. But apart from that, Stephen's reaction to David is very possessive and borderline a little bit jealous, you know? The film kind of speaks to the age-old struggle between teen girls who want their independence and then the even older struggle for fathers who desperately need to keep their teen daughter's virginity intact so that they would be suitable for marriage and a dowry later on. So the main conflict of the movie as it goes on is definitely between David and Stephen, and Nicole is just kind of a pawn in it all.
And just as we were talking about Fatal Attraction having a similar structure or borrowing fairly heavily from Madame Butterfly, to me, Fear really borrows from the fairy tale genre, except that if we take David as the prince going to save the princess, Nicole, the witch, who in this case would probably be her father, actually manages to keep her locked in the castle at the end of the movie and gets her to agree that this is the best place for her. There's a very interesting point in the final climactic battle between Nicole, David, and her father, where David says to Nicole, "You don't want to be a little girl forever, do you?" And it's such an interesting point because at the end, when they finally kill David, she kind of realizes, or it's certainly implied in the film, that she still is a little girl and she still needs to be protected, and she went outside of the norm and she went outside of what her family thought was best for her, and she paid a very high price for it. Not only her, but her friends died, several people were killed, injured, and all of that. So it's a very father knows best kind of morality tale. So again, that's all goes to speak to patriarchy. And if you look at her friend Margot, the slut played by Alyssa Milano, her father's gone. There's no mention of her father, but they do see her mother for a brief scene earlier on in the film, and she's going off to meet some random guy in a hotel. So there is the sense of, you know, women without that family structure are essentially trading on their sexuality. Now, there is, as we mentioned before, and there's such a huge part of this film, which is slut-shaming, particularly with the Margot character, but I think it goes even further than that. I think it's far more insidious. I think it's just sex-shaming to the point when David and Nicole first have sex, it cuts away and it's all very tender, and then her father finds a condom wrapper. Now, I would like to think as a parent, I'd just be happy that my child used protection and knew about protection and their partner was into it as well. So it just feels like there is this kind of danger in having sex. Both the father and the stepmother come from broken families, so there is a sense of preserving that purity. So if you look at both films, there are really three types of women. There's the slut, and that could be Alex or Margot. There is the slightly older woman in her 30s or 40s, and she is a wife, a mother, possibly a nag, really good at doing laundry. That would be either Laura or Beth. And then there is the virgin. There is the purity, which is Nicole. And that seems to be the most valued. That seems to have the most weight in terms of, as Andrew was saying, kind of like a dowry. And if we think about it, you know, it's certainly in the States, I know, it's not more than 100 years ago that rape was considered a property crime. So there is a sense of the ownership of a child's sexuality, which is, which is problematic at best, frankly.
Please.
Nicole. I know this is hard. I'm sorry it has to be like this. But it does. It's not our fault. It's his. I tried so hard to be nice, to get him to accept me. Can't you see all he wants is for you to be his little girl forever? You don't want that, do you?
If you look at the history of the sacrament of marriage, like it really is a transferal of ownership of a woman from her father to her husband, which is precisely why their last name changes. Like it's a very owning sacrament for a very owning culture. And thinking back to what you said about Stephen finding the condom in the room, I almost feel like it's significant that their first sexual encounter is in the house, because that is, you know, insofar as Nicole is Stephen's property, that's his property, that's his home. And that's also the incident where Nicole gives David the code to the house. So in the same night, you know, she gives up her V card and access to Stephen's fortress. Those events are kind of linked together insofar as they have to do with Stephen's ownership. There's also quite a bit of alpha male interplay between David and Stephen throughout the movie. When David first meets Stephen, he's perfectly respectful and nice and calls him sir and all that. And Stephen says, well, I want you to have her home at this time. And David says, yes, sir. But he kind of bosses Nicole around and he acts lecherous around Stephen's girlfriend, Laura, who really doesn't seem a whole lot older than these kids, you know? At one point, he kind of checks out Laura's legs and ass, and he gives Stephen this conspiratorial little smile, and Stephen doesn't like that one bit. And there's definitely alpha male struggle at play. Like, Nicole may be the one with the broken heart, but her heart is very much Stephen's property. And after a while, it's not even about Stephen anymore. And like, when David vandalizes Stephen's car, and Stephen trashes David's house, like, it's all about them.
David, I don't want to beat around the bush. I came to tell you that you're going to stop seeing Nicole. Now, either you're as smart as you think you are and you'll just go away, or else you're going to make things a lot harder on yourself than they have to be.
You know, Steve, you're really not a faggot.
What?
No, I'm serious. You seem like a pretty solid guy. You should lighten up on yourself.
We're not talking about me. We're talking...
Yes, we are. So that's what this whole thing's about, Steve. Your inadequacies, your fears.
You just wait a minute.
Now listen to me. See, I'm hip to your problems. All of them. I know you abandoned Nicole when she needed you most. Because I licked her sweet tears. I know about things coming apart at work. Maybe you fucking lost it in that department. I also know you ain't keeping up, so to speak, your end of the bargain with the missus. Because if you were, she wouldn't be all over my stick. But relax, Steve. We're friends. We're practically family.
I want you to understand something, pal. If you don't disappear from my family's life, I'm gonna rip your balls off and shove them so far up your ass they'll come out your fucking mouth. You got that, my friend?
And I believe it's a note that David leaves on the car. Now I popped your other cherry. Ooh. Which, yeah, and the car is red.
That's gotta hurt.
So, symbolism. Just going to leave it there. And it goes back to what we were talking about with Dan in Fatal Attraction, is that in these films, as I was just mentioning, the three kind of archetypes for women, there's one for men, and that is that they are all sex and impulse and violent impulse. So there is a sense of they can't control their urges, and it is, you know, women who lead them to kind of do these things. It's the sexuality, it's the unattainability which guides them to behave like this.
It's Adam and Eve in the Forbidden Fruit.
Ooh, I got chills.
Yeah, really? I mean, Nicole and her father are very close. At least it's implied that they were very close prior to Laura coming into the picture. And, you know, blended families weren't terribly uncommon in 1996, but again, as with the single 30-something, they weren't in films a whole lot. And step-parents were still largely stigmatized as being evil or unfeeling for their stepchildren or favoring their biological children over their stepchildren. Nicole's closeness with her father is threatened by her adolescence in both her sexuality and in Laura, who kind of polices her sexuality a little bit. Like, speaking of slut shaming, Nicole's stepmom shames her at one point for wearing too much makeup and revealing clothing. You know, it's clear that they're not very far apart in age, and I think Nicole really resents being told what to do from someone barely older than her. But without a concrete mother figure, her sexual education is kind of suspect. You know, she has all the protection from her father, but no real guidance from a female counterpart. Speaking for myself, my official sexual education came from both the Catholic school system, which is to say nothing at all, and a certain book that I've actually looked up, and we can post a link to if you guys want to take a laugh at my not my sex life, but what the preamble to it.
No, I'm gonna picture that as your sex life.
Yeah, the cover right there. Yeah. It's called "What Teens Want to Know About Love, Dating, and Sex" by George B. Eager. And I don't have a date on it, but judging by the cover, we've got a young Aryan couple, both in denim jackets, and she's got a pink scrunchie on. So I'm going to say the 80s. I'm just going to go ahead and say it.
And it's a pencil drawing.
It is a pencil illustration, so it is fantastic. Now, obviously, this book has exactly what you would expect in terms of a woman's virginity being her gift. You know, it's something that she has that she can choose to award to somebody. And I even remember there being an illustration of a diamond ring in that chapter. So, yeah, which is kind of really fucked up. Because, yeah, it's just, you know, your sex is a diamond ring that you give in exchange for a diamond ring of matrimony, Jesus, right? Yeah. And then there was a whole chapter on how every time you have sex is Russian roulette with AIDS and death and pregnancy, which in the premarital sense is tantamount to death or perhaps worse. What does this have to do with fear?
Sexy?
It's not very sexy. Anti-sex. Man-hating.
Well, I think that point just goes to show that in real life, I think we all just try to look at sex as something pleasurable that you share with, you know, someone or some people that you care about, and you try to make the best decisions, but, you know, you're working on emotions, and those don't always lead to the best decisions. But I think we see time and again in both of these films is that it's not necessarily about pleasure, or when it is about pleasure, it's dangerous, and it's uncontrollable, and it leads to death or destruction of your family and destruction of the things you hold dear. And it's a very black and white portrayal of sex, which is unfortunate because it's a much more complicated issue. And while both these films are fun in their own right and a good, you know, easy watch when you're hungover, it's not always the best message. And, you know, thank God I didn't take it to heart when I saw these movies when I was younger. Oh, I sound like a slut.
I think Alex needs to read this book quick. I wish I still had it. I really do. But yeah, we chose these two movies. They're both movies about obsession and madness, but they're also about consequences and consequences to sexuality and who owns sexuality and the dualism between family and sexuality, which is crazy because you think that they would go hand in hand, but clearly they don't.
And another thing these films both kind of deal with, particularly Fatal Attraction, but I think you could also make an argument for Fear, is morals. What are your moral boundaries? Because morals in their essence, I think, are, you know, they come and go and they can make points and they can leave. And, you know, your morals change and they evolve the more you learn, the older you get. But these are pretty sacrosanct. These are, you know, as we were just speaking about, they're pretty Puritan values that they're both enforcing. Now, what I find really interesting about this is, you know, that's all fine and good, but there's nothing to say that what Alex or David wants is irrational. They're both attracted to their, you know, to their partner or the person they want to be their partner, and they both want to have a family with that. I mean, Alex is pregnant by, you know, halfway through the movie. She wants to have a family. She wants a nuclear family. You know, I'm not saying they both go about it the best way, but there's certainly nothing wrong with that, or there's nothing wrong in wanting that. So there is another patriarchal hand in, you know, saying, well, this is right because it is deemed correct by this power source. But it is deemed incorrect or crazy or bad or hysterical because someone outside of a power source does want it, and it has to be stopped. And when it doesn't stop, when they are asked to stop, then it gets violent and it gets bloody and people lose their lives.
So just before we wrap up, we just want to talk a little bit about how these movies wrap up. Because what's really interesting about these movies are the kills. You know, at the end, we've got the victims, we've got the villains, and the victims kill the villains, or at least in the endings that were published and distributed, shamefully so in the case of Fatal Attraction. But the kills are significant because these were all the wrongs are righted, and the victim is supposed to kill the perp who wounded them. Now, in Fatal Attraction, we've got this whole thing culminating into Alex attacking Beth, and she's attacking her in the bathroom, which is kind of a vulnerable spot, you know? And Alex has convinced herself that Beth is what is standing in the way of their love, and that if she can just do away with her, then her and Dan can be together forever. But when Alex attacks Beth in the bathroom, it's Dan who intervenes, almost drowns her in the tub, but Beth is the one who delivers the final killing blow, shooting her in the chest. Kind of brings to mind the question of who really is the victim here? Who is it that Alex has wronged specifically? And she's definitely wronged them both, and she's torn them apart. But this is something Alex pointed out when we were talking about this before we started recording, is that the fact that Dan and Beth come together to kill her is kind of a resealing of the rift that Alex caused, you know, that they dealt with it together.
And similarly, at the end of Fear, when David's, you know, laying into her father, Nicole picks up the peace pipe that, again, he won her at the fair before the finger-banging incident, and she stabs him in the back. She stabs David in the back. David kind of turns around with this, "Why, Nicole?" kind of look. And then Nicole backs away and continues to kind of whimper in the corner while it is her father who, again, you know, tussles with David and then throws him out a window. So, again, it's a deep parallel that Andrea pointed out that I hadn't realized, where, you know, you have the victim kind of deal them a blow, but their partner or someone who they had a rift with deal the killing blow. As Andrea articulated just seconds ago, it is that resealing of an emotional relationship because, you know, the family that kills together stays together. So in conclusion to our second episode, I think we've seen that in both films, the family start out as pretty okay. There are some flaws, you know. Dan and Beth live in a small apartment. They're always stubbing their toe and stepping on their dog, but they generally have a happy home life. In Fear, Nicole is kind of a sullen teenager. She's generally a good kid, but, you know, she's dealing with an entire change to her life. Nothing drastic, nothing dangerous. But it is the intrusion of an outside force, of an outside person that offers a sexual liaison that tempts one person in that family to leave. They ultimately reject that person, have to face the consequences because of that, and their family actually becomes stronger and they become more solidified as a nuclear family perpetrating the values that have been handed down to us by Puritans, that marriage is sacred, that sexuality is sacred, and that sex can only truly exist in a safe way within a marriage, within commitment.
No, that's right. And the other message is kind of that there are consequences to sex. Whether you're in a relationship or outside of one, there are other people involved in your sexuality, which, you know, isn't something that I'm totally thrilled about. Not to talk about me again, but that book is kind of always in the room whenever I'm trying to get down. And we thought these two movies were interesting illustrations on sexuality and their impact on the family unit. And we thought for our Valentine's Day episode, we would kill everyone's buzz with this cold shower of a man-hating topic, and we hope that everybody has a very happy and safe Valentine's Day. Use protection, or better, just get married, and then you'll be fine, according to that book.
Actually, Andrea, before we go, I want to show you something. I know you guys at home won't be able to see this, but I'm just going to lift up my shirt, and yeah, Andrea forever. My abs are remarkably similar to Mark Wahlberg's. I did his workout.
That's amazing. Good for you.
So thank you again for listening. So you can subscribe to us on iTunes. We are on iTunes. You can find us on Podomatic, which is podomatic.com/facultyofhorror. We're on the Modern Superior Network, so you should check us out there and check out. They have a bunch of other great podcasts. And thank you for all the support and for people listening to us. I do want to say we have had a couple questions about it, but we are going to be uploading, I think, like one episode a month. So probably around the beginning of each month, you'll see an episode from us pop up because we need the time and we want to give you quality goods. And It takes a long time to carve Andrea into flesh. And with that, again, happy Valentine's Day from us at Faculty of Horror. Office hours are closed. We'll talk to you soon. Graceless ladies.